Welcome to We Are Libertarians. I'm your host, Chris Spangle. We bring you all of the irreverence modern politics deserves while putting people before political parties. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective with the goal of leaving you better informed. Please be sure to rate and review us on iTunes or Google Play. Like us on Facebook and subscribe at Patreon on Patreon at WeAreLibertarians.com. In exchange for supporting our program, we give you all kinds of bonus content and free stuff. This show is crowdsourced, so you can send us news in our Facebook group and Discord channel. And we are always taking your questions and comments via email at editor@WeAreLibertarians.com. That is the best way to get a hold of the show if you want to talk to me directly, editor@WeAreLibertarians.com. Please be warned that the show is raw, unedited, and authentic, so the language is sometimes strong and offensive. I have a very special show. It's the introduction of a very cool series and possible breakout podcast from the series coming soon. I'm going to talk to my friend Rob, Rob Cortell, who is a member of the Swamp. And I met him in a very odd way, totally unexpectedly this February, as I traveled to Students for Liberty at their LibertyCon in February. And I got trapped in a snowstorm in the Philly train station. And this very well-dressed, you know, nice man walks up, and we just start talking as we're waiting for our Ubers. And I mentioned I'm driving to Washington, D.C., and he asked if he can. I said, hey, you want to ride? And so he joined me, and we talked for a couple hours. And as we're going through this conversation, I'm just like, this guy has, he knows everybody. He knows everything. And as I say to him, I had to Google just to make sure that he was telling the truth. But there's videos of him on C-SPAN, and he's just a very fascinating guy. He's been in Washington, D.C. for about 40 years. He's worked on three presidential campaigns at very high levels. He's been Senate confirmed. He's a member on the Council on Foreign Relations, for instance. So he is the Swamp, and we joked about that. And I said, you know, I'd love to have you come on the show and kind of explain the Swamp to people, because I think it would be interesting for those of us who don't live in Washington to get an idea of how Washington, D.C. works. And essentially, if you want to change America towards a libertarian future, you have to understand the structures of power, because you can't change those structures of power if you don't work within them. Although some people would argue against that, that's generally been the way that I've found is the quickest and easiest way to go about it, or at least you can influence it. So I wanted to bring on Rob and start a series of conversations with him about his opinion on politics and what he hears when he's at the bar in Washington, D.C. and hanging out at these various events. And I think he's a very interesting guy. This was a very interesting conversation. I'd love for you to check it out. If you have questions, then please send me an email, editor@WeAreLibertarians.com, and we'll ask them of Rob on future shows. But without further ado, here's my conversation with Rob Cortell. Rob Cortell, live from the Swamp. How are you doing, Rob?
I'm barking up some alligators.
What does that mean?
Well, I'm in the Swamp, right?
Yes. Now, are you actually in Washington, D.C. right now?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So you live and work in Washington, D.C., and about how long have you been in the Swamp?
Oh, my God. I've been here nearly, 45 years, actually, since I drove here from Texas out of college looking for a job. And landed one in the very first day at one of the early Swamp creatures, the Environmental Protection Agency. And here I am 45 years later, living in Logan Circle, which is about 8 blocks from the White House, dead center.
Yeah. I dropped you off and I was like, oh yeah, this is pretty swampy.
Yeah, right.
So
it's actually pretty nice.
I stayed at a hotel there in 2013 and walked the neighborhood. It's beautiful. It's what a great place to live.
Now, tourists like it. I like it.
Let's actually talk about how we met, first of all, because it's kind of a weird story. I have posted the travel log that I did for my trip to the Students for Liberty conference. And you played a very small part in that story as told, because I knew we would do this eventually. But We were both stranded in the Philadelphia train station. I'm waiting for an Uber, and then you just start chatting me up as we were both stranded in the middle of the first of the four nor'easters. So
that's true. I was on I had a board meeting up in New Haven, Connecticut, got on the train in the morning, sat there for 2 hours, started snowing, just shy of Trenton. They told us we were going to have to get off the train, and go back south. And I got bumped in Philly just like you did. And, somehow I didn't believe that they were really going to get us out the next morning. So, and as you probably described, the snow was going sideways.
It was insane.
It was so cold. It was insane. But the Uber line with its 40 people or so was a lot shorter than the taxi line, which wrapped 1.5 times around that station, which is as big as a whole city block. So you're right. We started chatting, and you made an offer. You said you were going to the Libertarian Convention, and I mentioned I was going to Washington, and you said, would you like a ride? And I said, of course.
And then
we chatted the whole way down. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then I made you pay half. So
that's right. That's true.
Yeah, so we started talking, and then as we get through the conversation, I'm like, this guy really knows everybody and everything. And like to the point that I'm not going to lie to you, I got home and I Googled your name just to make sure you were telling the truth, because it was just so like, how can one person know Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and like be at the center of politics? Like, I guess when you live out in the hinterlands and you follow politics, but you're not necessarily side stage for modern histories as you have been, you don't realize that there are just a group of individuals who have been a part of that. And I think we sometimes think about modern politics in Washington, D.C. as like a monolith. But it really is just a group of people like yourself who have been involved in a for a long time, and there is that I don't know the best way to describe it. The best insight that I've had is Mark Leibovich's This Town book, where it's a lot of cocktail parties and dinner at 5:30. You always remind me it's 5:30. I've got to go get cocktails.
I actually think it's less of that than people tend to think in the political atmosphere. When I started with Ford, of course, I was a kid. I was 20, I guess I was 25 years old, and so I was a small cog. But he did later come down and campaign for me when I ran for Congress, and I at the time, I think one of the things that got reported in the newspapers I remember seeing in Atlanta was that I was more Reagan than Reagan, which I was surprised to be.
Mm-hmm.
But. You know, I do. I actually think one of the problems with Washington today is that there is a lot less of the interaction in the cocktail party circuit or at the bar or breakfast or any of those things among the political classes. So, you know, today most of what I do is business. So I told you that I spent a lot of time working with startups. So, you know, I always offer these kids. And I say kids, they're your age and younger.
Right.
And I offer them 8 o'clock breakfast or 5:30 cocktails, and you know which one they always pick. But it's a good way to learn about people. And you know, kind of in the old days when I was first here, people actually did that and they got to know each other. And, you know, the story that Reagan used to always tell was that he and Tip O'Neill could fight all day long, but they'd end up at the White House having, you know, a drink on the balcony. And I really don't think that happens very much anymore. I think the money and the race for money and the tactical ideological battles kind of overwhelm a lot of that process. So I think things would be much better off here if people did more drinking.
And just so you know, I'm killing my video just so the connection is better. Okay. So you get to Washington in 71, and you're at the beginning of the EPA. What did you do for, we'll kind of go through your history and introduce you to the audience, but what did you do at the EPA in the beginning?
Well, so I think, as you know, I like to say that I have been in three government startups, half a dozen business startups, half a dozen or more not-for-profit or type startups and things. So I actually like being in organizations at the beginning. I actually worked at the EPA when I was in college. Nixon created the EPA, Office of Management and Budget, kind of the modern version of government. And I took environmental science and biology at Rice University. And when they opened their doors in 1971, the regional office was in Houston. And my professor was the head of the region. And so I was able to get a part-time job. So I really started working back in Houston in 71. And then when I graduated in 73, I drove home for 2 days in Florida and Orlando. And the next day drove straight to Washington. A guy from Rice was the deputy administrator. This was the days of Ruckelshaus. He let me in right away, and I basically walked out with a job. That guy, Bob Fry, became very prominent and was a very beloved kind of figure here. He later headed the Energy Research Organization and then the Smithsonian Institution. He was a very good guy. So I was there about probably really only 4 or 5 months in Washington. And when I arrived, I was put in charge of the water quality rules for timber. And despite the fact that I had a degree in environmental science and biology, I used to like to say I had grown up in Florida and therefore never seen a tree. So I was a 23-year-old kid. I was writing the rules. And we, of course, had consultants and all that. But it was smack in the middle of the Arab oil embargo, which I'm sure a lot of people don't even today realize happened. But OPEC, the Arab oil cartel, cut the U.S. off, basically. And I had by that time met a number of people at the Republican National Committee. You know, I'm a Republican, and I love to network and meet people. And so by that time, I had met some people at the White House and this and that. And Nixon created the Federal Energy Office. He also put on price controls and other things. But the idea of the Federal Energy Office was to figure out what to do about all this. And one of the things that I remember doing was before I got there was to calculate the number of barrels of oil it would take to light the Washington Monument. And there were people who actually considered shutting it down. But so I was there about a year, and that was a very interesting organization. It was great for a young person like me. I was, as I said, by then I was 24. And I had a good education, and basically they threw a bunch of young people and a bunch of young, highly educated managers from Harvard Business School and McKinsey and some of those consulting firms onto the problem. And so that was a terrific experience for a young person.
So can we go back to the EPA and,
yeah.
And you explained the development of the Office of Energy. Was it Office of Energy Data Policy? Is that the—
Well, that came later. So,
okay.
So in the sequence, I was the EPA for a while and got pulled into this Federal Energy Office out of the White House. And actually, the first day I walked in was I walked into Nelson Rockefeller's office where it was sort of headquartered. Nominally, there were only a handful of people, maybe 50 people. And I walked in, and the head of the agency had already been fired, Governor John Love. And they appointed a business guy, Bill Simon, became what people fondly called the energy czar. So he was the first energy czar. And he had to deal with price controls and power wheeling. And for people that don't know what that is, you know, power is produced in one place and run down electric wires to some other place that has a deficit. So we were moving power from Canada down to the States in the Midwest. So I was there for about a year, and then they converted it into an actual federal agency, the Federal Energy Administration, through an act of Congress. And that's when my job, I ended up in the office of the Office of Energy Data Policy is what it evolved into. And our job was to get all the data and statistics we could about about energy and the problem and who was using it and all of that, and help guide policymakers.
So can you, let's go back to the EPA, and
yeah.
What was the reasoning for the formation of the EPA?
Well, so that was 73. So if you think back into the late 60s, well, of course, Rachel Carson, all the way back, you know, back in the late 50s, wrote her book, and that was the beginning of the environmental movement.
The Silent Spring.
Silent Spring. And then in the 60s, which was a highly activist period, and I went to college in 1968 when it was in full swing, the environment was a big deal. And there was no single place in the government to kind of manage the rules. The Clean Air Act was passed. The Clean Water Act was passed. This was all part of Nixon's modernization of government. You know, I think people forget that there had been no major reform of the federal government probably in 50 years until that time. And everything was intended to streamline. He actually had considered putting together some of the agencies into super cabinet offices. So the EPA was part of that streamlining. And early on, they had a mandate basically to clean up the water and clean up the air. I dare say most people your age have never experienced smog like the kind they used to have on the West Coast, and we would have periodically on the East Coast. There literally used to be a smog index every day. So that was really the first attempt to pull all that together.
So would you? So basically, there was a public outcry, and there became. This pattern probably, and we know it goes on today. But I wondered if it happened back then. There's a public outcry. Somebody writes a book. Everybody goes, oh, there's A, profit, or B, this is a crisis. They create a public hysteria, and then Congress passes law, and then there's all these rules and regulations, and nobody to actually enforce them and manage them. Is that kind of the short of it?
There are way too many people to enforce and manage them these days, but it's sort of like that. I mean, that is the archetypal way things get done in Washington. People wait for a good crisis. I forgot who said, "Never waste a good crisis." But
Rahm Emanuel, yeah.
Yeah, Rahm Emanuel, right. And EPA was more a percolation. You know, that kind of percolated for a number of years, and then the various environmental laws were passed. So it was really kind of a natural evolution. I think they pulled elements out of the Department of Interior. They pulled elements out of other departments. So EPA was a little more benign in those days than it seems to be these days. Although it didn't take long to start trying to figure out how to regulate the economy in terms of, environmental impact and everything else. And of course, that's only one set of regulatory laws that the public knows about. You know, when at one point I was building a company in Texas, we were building oil storage domes to fill for commercial use and with oil. Lo and behold, there's a law that the Antiquities Act, I guess, is a law that requires you do archaeological research too. We indeed were stopped for about a year and a half because we dug and found the oldest Spanish artifact that had ever been discovered in Texas at that time.
Just your luck.
Yeah, right. That's right. Although, you know, it's a good thing. And we did mitigation and that all worked out fine. So there's supposed to be balances. I think most of us get upset when the balance kind of goes out of whack.
So compare the EPA back when you started to what the EPA is now. I assume you are familiar with what the EPA is now and Scott Pruitt, and we'll ask about him next. But compare the difference between 1971 EPA and what it has grown into over the course of time.
Well, I'm not sure I would do it justice. I don't actually follow the EPA that closely. I will say I was at a meeting with Scott Pruitt and a number I could only call them lobbyists. There were about 20 of us in the room, mostly from the mining industry, and we introduced ourselves around the room. And of course, it's in this mammoth headquarters now. When I was at the EPA, we were at a small office out in Houston and then get to Washington. And we were a modern building in an area that had been kind of part of the blighted area of Washington. It was all a new development, and that was nice. But it's in a much, I think the staff is much bigger, and they, of course, have many more mandates and many more rules. But so I did meet Pruitt at that point, and he is an interesting guy. He, independently of the issues around the ethical behavior, which by almost any standard are pretty, I don't know how I'd call them. They're not very thoughtful. Let's just put it that way. he did hit on one point, which I think it would be better if he argued it more frequently than some of the things they do, which was that what he said was that he only intended to enforce the law, that he was pro-environment and pro-blah-blah-blah. And I'm willing to take him at face for a little bit, but he went on to say that what he felt his mandate was to have the agency live inside the law. And we do know that there are a number of programmatic approaches that have been implemented by presidents from probably from Reagan on, but certainly from Obama, and before that George W. Bush, and before that Bill Clinton, that came about because the presidents get kind of frustrated with the fact that the Congress never seems to do anything. So their response, the response of an activist, any president, is, well, if I can't get them to do it, I'm going to write a law myself. And if I can't write a law, I'm going to write a rule it by executive order.
Yeah, we're seeing that with the Iran deal. I mean, this is the...
Yeah.
I mean,
in both directions, by the way.
Yeah, you want to go back to Obama and say, hey, you remember when everybody was saying obey the Constitution? Well, now you're seeing why, is because the next guy who is fundamentally different than you on the exact opposite side of every issue you believe in can go in and just completely overturn everything you did when it's all done through the executive branch.
Absolutely, by executive order. And in the case of, for example, the coal actions under the administration, under the Obama administration, they actually had lost the initial case in the court towards the end of the administration. So, and it was on that basis. And, you know, at some point in the future, we can talk about that. But it's not the first executive action to be overturned. It's not the first overreach. And you're correct about Iran in that it's effectively a treaty, and it wasn't approved by the Congress per se. So I think technically it's not called a treaty. So
yeah,
that's how they get around it.
So let's hop back on your career path. You end up as the deputy policy director for the Presidential Clemency Board. What is the Presidential Clemency Board?
Well, so at one point, when Jerry Ford became president, and Nixon resigned and he became president and flew off in the helicopter, he, within a matter of a day or two, pardoned Nixon. And he did that to because there was so much controversy, and there were calls for Nixon to be put on trial and publicly hung effectively. And he just wanted to get it over with. It had been a very long period. The whole Watergate thing was pretty awful in a lot of respects for society.
Wasn't it about two years total?
Oh, it was easily 2 years. And you know, it began with people who, in some ways, it was tied up with this whole issue of press intensely disliking Nixon for a variety of reasons. And then, of course, he stepped into it, and then they went after him. And I suppose there are some parallels to the current situation. But so Ford became president, pardoned Nixon, big outcry, and he then his advisors decided to set up a commission and to pardon Vietnam-era draft evaders. So there was this sort of mythology that there are a lot of American kids who fled to Canada. And so he set this up. It was called the Presidential Clemency Board. And a president is allowed to spend a certain amount of money out of his budget on a program like this as long as it ends in less than a year. So the board was set up to run for 364 days. And they brought in a great group of smart people, as always, and had a really interesting board. General Lewis Walt, who had been head of the Marine Corps, sort of counterpoint to Lew Puller, who was the son of General Chesty Puller, who is the Marines. He's virtually a god in the Marine Corps. He's the most beloved Marine of all time. And his son had gone to Vietnam and lost an arm and I think a leg and or two legs and then later went on to become a lawyer and very prominent. But, you know, he suffered from all of the issues that young men did in that era and eventually committed suicide after he got married and had kids and got divorced and on. But he was a great guy. And then Joanne Vinson was the head of MIA POWs, missing in action POWs, and one or two friends of the president's, and Charlie Goodell was a former senator.
I'm just listening to this they're putting people who really put up a lot in the Vietnam War in charge of letting off the draft dodgers.
Yeah, and you know, it was, well, the attempt was to heal this divisive kind of situation. And so he set this up, and over time, the board eventually recruited about 500 lawyers. That's, you're allowed to assign employees from one agency to another on a temporary basis. And so they were eventually recruited about 500 lawyers and a management team from the Peace Corps and a couple of really smart people. And the general counsel was a guy named Larry Baskier, and the deputy manager for the clemency board was a guy named Bob Knisley. I was under the head of the management, so I was a deputy to him. A guy named Bill Strauss, who eventually wrote a book, Chance and Circumstance, which he was able to do by virtue of collecting the data publicly from all the cases. And so the board got set up, and they had some people apply, and they immediately broadened the scope to not just be draft evaders, because they figured out pretty quickly there probably were not 15 people, if that many, who fled to Canada. But there were
Was it really?
Hundreds.
Yeah, okay, huh? So it was hundreds. It was not 15 people.
It was probably about 15 people. But there were, in fact, there were tens of thousands of young men and some women who had bad discharges, who they'd gotten caught in the system. They had the classic case that I've written about in other instances was an African-American soldier who had had three tours of duty in Vietnam, been wounded a couple times. On his third tour, returning home through Germany, got caught on a drug charge and cashiered entirely. He lost his medical benefits, his retirement benefits. It was like he had never done anything to help the country, to serve the country. And that would be as much the norm. That was the way the system worked in those days, as anything else. So so they put out this call for all of these kids, and they got some number and didn't have enough. What Chance and Circumstance talked about, and again, Vietnam would be, and current wars would be another interesting topic in the future, was there were, I can't remember the number, but it was tens and tens of millions of young Americans were eligible by virtue of their age to go to that war. 51% were automatically not drafted, and that means all women, and so you have that number. And then 2 or 3 million, again, we can talk about this at some point in the future, actually went over the course of the war. And then there were tens of thousands. I think it was 42 or 3,000 killed in that conflict over time. And, of course, we thought that one dragged on forever. And, right. You know, Iraq has gone on, you know, several years past that.
Oh, I mean, there's kids in Afghanistan right now. I mean, there are people serving in Afghanistan who have no cognitive memory of 9/11. I mean,
that's
almost
exactly
20
right.
years. Yeah.
So at the time, of course, we thought it had gone on, and more people were killed in that. Approximately the number of people who used to get killed on the highways every year. But so in the entire population of the United States, only a small handful had actually had to suffer the burden of executing the war. And there's a kind of social unfairness about that, including the fact that if you were wealthy enough, you go to college and keep going to graduate school and get a deferment. If you had a bone spur,
let's say bone spurs, yeah.
From someone we know, you could get out. if uh, And then Nixon at some point implemented the draft lottery, and my number was 316. I will remember it to the day I'm dead. They would have had to nuke the White House before they called me up, and I had been in Navy ROTC up until that point. But in any case, so the Clemency Board actually, it was trying to reach all these young men and some women, and really didn't get a lot of a response. So we literally took out ads in Playboy magazine, and there was a big ad during the Super Bowl that year, and in the end, we had 35,000 to 38,000 applicants, and we ran them all through this process in 364 days. And the process, this is the guy who was my boss in who ran the management operation, had gone to Kennedy School, the Harvard School, Harvard and Harvard Law School, and brilliant, brilliant guy. And he immediately started looking at the numbers. So on the first pass or two or three through the board, they looked at some number, a couple dozen cases, and gave them a sentence, or they let them off, or they gave them this or that. And he went back and looked and kind of quantified the factors in their cases and figured out that the decisions were entirely random.
Hmm.
And therefore not not necessarily fair, and certainly not transparent. So he came up with what he called aggravating and mitigating factors, and he got the board to agree on what constituted each of those. And there might be a dozen things, like you were wounded in combat would be considered a mitigating factor, and aggravating factor is you were caught using drugs on the front line, or you know, you'd gotten in brawls or whatever like that. But and so he made them vote, so they were specific decision criteria, and then the staff would go through each case, all these lawyers, and they look at them and they say, I think these four aggravating factors and these six mitigating factors apply, and I'd recommend this outcome. And then that would go through the board, and the board could agree or disagree, but they at least would state these reasons. And then one of the things that was very interesting to me, you know, today, some however many 40 years later, you know, I my company does decision analytics and predictive analytics and all that, and we use some of those kinds of ideas in technology. They're like rules. So you hear about rule systems. So that was an early rule systems, and it was really virtually pre-computer, and all we had were IBM Selectric 2s to type with, which, again, no one who's listening probably even knows what that is, but it's a typewriter. You know what a typewriter is? It was an electric typewriter that had a little back button that could erase, you know, what you had just typed, which was a major breakthrough in those days.
I think my mom had one of those. Now that I'm thinking about,
sure, your mother had one, and
yeah,
your grandparents might even have had them.
Yeah.
But so we managed to, and then we ran a regression analysis on each case against everyone that had gone through to see if it seemed to fall within some statistical range. So this was like this was the ultimate fairness, that if you had the same kind of circumstances, you'd end up in the same place. And we would, you know, some of the soldiers had their benefits restored, their health care, medical care restored, and things like that, partial benefits, got pardons, whatever. And so that was a very, very, in my mind, one of the most successful government experiences I've ever seen. And, you know, it's kind of today, I'm not an expert in the pardon, presidential pardon system and the federal pardon system, but, you know, we have these big backlogs of people, and it is sort of random. And of course, it can be entirely by virtue of random decision. If you want, if the president wants to pardon somebody, he can't, doesn't have a reason, but some of these principles could apply to a lot of other places.
Well,
you know, you think about it.
Well, to think that you had 35,000 to 38,000 soldiers who served in Vietnam, or, you know, did they serve, or they were drafted and called up, or
some may have been drafted. Some may have, some were drafted. Some may have volunteered. Some may never have gone over. But you know, that's, you think about the 2 to 3 million people, again, I think it's closer to two, but who went, As a percentage of the population, it was, you know, it's like you're talking 1% of the population bore the burden of the entire war.
And then to have that many thousands of people have wrongly been stripped of their benefits, I mean, that's a pretty significant number. So it's a pretty cool achievement.
Yeah. And not all of them got that back. You know, some of them applied who didn't have enough mitigating factors or anything else. So the intent was not to do something that any other soldier would have disagreed with. And I will say what was really interesting, and this is sort of this was a really interesting thing to watch. General Walt had been head of the Marine Corps, as I said, and Lew Puller, Lew Walt, General Walt, was in his late 50s, probably early 60s, and a real kind of a bear kind of curmudgeon and really a tough guy. And on the same commission making decisions was Lew Puller, who was in his, if he was 30 then, I'd be surprised, and had been maimed by the war, yet whose dad was the most famous Marine of all time. And we all remember General Walt saying to him, your father would be rolling in his grave at your decisions. So you can imagine that Lew Puller was forgiving and sympathetic and had empathy because he had been one of those soldiers.
Right.
And then, of course, Joanne Vincent and virtually all of the others, I think, who had family who'd gone to war themselves, I mean, or lost husbands, like Joanne, they were likewise, they understood. Their husbands had been killed in the war and or never came back, never found necessarily. So they had a real empathy towards this very, very unpopular war and the scars it inflicted on all these soldiers. So, you know, today we have all these military veterans coming back with psychological issues and PTSD and all of that, in addition to all the wounds from which they survive. Which they didn't used to survive many of these wounds.
Let me ask
you. So we see it today.
Yeah. So I assume you interacted with a tremendous amount of these people, right?
Well, actually, no. They sent their applications in. The lawyers would call them and interview them. Some of them may well have come before the board, but it was really a bureaucratic process. Think about how most government applications work. Basically, you fill out a document, it goes to a bureaucrat. And by the way, you and I both know that bureaucrat was intended not to be a negative term, but a positive term. Bismarck created bureaucrats and bureaucracies in order to regularize the process of government. But it's come to have a different meaning in these days, as you well know.
Sure. But it's their own fault. It doesn't work.
Kinda, yeah, I agree with that. And some are good, and some are not so good. You know, so
yeah. On that point, I would say that there is. Man, I was just watching coverage of the primaries in West Virginia last night, and ABC tweeted out this guy talking to a reporter. And there was this nut who was running in West Virginia. We talked about him on the last episode of the show where he was talking about Cocaine Mitch and he's beholden to China people. You know, Mitch has an Asian wife, so it was a little cringy.
Was that Blankenship?
Yeah, Don Blankenship. And he went to jail for unsafe working conditions that caused the death of 29 people. And so this guy that was being interviewed after he voted, three of his cousins had died in the mine blasts.
Right.
And he said he voted for Don Blankenship. And the reporter's face, I mean, he couldn't believe it. He goes, why would you vote for Don Blankenship? And he just goes, well, they're all crooks, so at least he's an honest crook. And I just thought, people are so cynical about their own government that they're going to vote for a guy that killed his...
You have to hope that is... an aberration. That's really crazy.
I don't know. I mean,
of course, he didn't win, so that's a good thing.
Well, in Indiana, we had a guy who won with 40% of the vote in a three-way race. That was a very, very contested race, and he was a Democrat until 2012. I mean, the next Republican nominee for the Senate in Indiana voted for Hillary or Obama. And he did it by spending $6 million of his own money, outspending his two opponents who spent two each on TV, by just saying, I'm an outsider, and it worked. And so I have to ask, I mean, you interact with a lot of people who work in Washington, D.C. I think we are far too cynical and far too groupthinky out in the rest of the country that there's a reason the Swamp Thing works. Like, it's just it's just a collection of people who are out to steal from the government and use the government for their own interests. And I know that happens. I mean, I'm sure it does. But by and large, do you find people who are mostly motivated by power, or are they mostly motivated by the concept of public service? Like, they're really trying to do their best. Their ideas may just be flawed, or the bureaucracy, for example, doesn't work. I mean, what is the general flavor of the people that you interact with that make up the bureaucracy of the United States government?
So that's a good setup. Some of the most intelligent, patriotic, thoughtful people I've ever met have been in the government. And some of the laziest people I've ever met, thoughtless, don't care about it, I've met in the private sector.
Hmm.
So you get some of both. And I've met plenty of people in the government who are serving their time, but I also know plenty of people in the private sector who are serving their time. And, you know, I'm in technology, and not all technology is startup technology. But by and large, most government workers are not people with what you think of traditionally as power. The people who have the power are the appointees. At least they have public power in the sense that they can command a different direction and emphasize or de-emphasize some aspect of the law. And I was in one of those slots years ago, although I didn't have a lot of power as an independent commissioner. But I think most people are motivated by the same things that everybody else is motivated by. You know, I need money, I want to have a job, I like what I'm doing, or I don't like what I'm doing, but I'm going to do it till I retire. And some agencies are better than others. And then some places are restrained by the way the law has been written by the Congress. So, for example, the Veterans Administration, and again, I don't want to delve deeply into that today, but you know, we've all read about this long line of veterans applying for benefits and months of waiting and all that. And as a technology guy, I'm pretty convinced that that's a process that you could truncate and make efficient and almost automatic decision on benefits or whatever. But the way the law is written, if you apply for a benefit and you're not eligible for it quite yet by virtue of age or something else, you basically, the case file has to be recreated from scratch when you go back to apply when you're eligible. Or and for the longest time, I don't know if it's still true today, but I think it's probably in the law somewhere, anybody could apply on a napkin, basically. You can write, you know, I'm a soldier and I need benefits. So, you know, nothing is quite that simple, but it's sort of like that. So the law is frequently written in ways that you can't get around. Now, my experience in general with bureaucrats, the professionals in the government, are that they do a remarkable job of trying to reflect the position of the politicians who govern them. So, you know, they may not like it or agree with it. They have the right to explain a position, but by and large, they bend pretty well with the changing tides. Some burrow deep in and don't want to do that. You know, there's this process which we call burrowing in. After every administration, it's happened for 100 years. People who were political appointees get themselves a civil service rating, and then find a way to stay in the agency under civil service protections.
What does that mean?
Well, there are a variety of processes that are, again, very similar to what we see in a lot of private sector companies, particularly large companies. You know, as you get, the bigger you get, the more difficult it becomes to fire people or move them around or reduce benefits or anything like that. So a lot of the characteristics of the government come about by virtue of its size, pure size. So, you know, an organization with 10,000 people in the public sector is going to be almost as difficult to manage as an organization with 10,000 people in the private sector. It's a size issue and a management issue and all that. So everybody sets up rules to protect themselves. So labor law is, you know, it's very similar in different places. We like to think it's not. It's hard to fire somebody in the civil service. You have the right. Many of the agencies, but not all the agencies, have partially unionized employees. So they have contracts, and you have to deal with those. But private sector companies do too, right? So, mm-hmm. But I do think the reality is that a lot of what we tend to think as sloth and everything else is process that someone has created under the theory that they are making things more efficient and and more immune to bad actors. But it's like federal contracting. I've watched federal contracting for 40 years on both sides of it. And every 4 years, every new president, someone comes in and says, I'm going to reform it. And they don't know what they're talking about when they get there. They don't know enough about the ins and outs of the way the system actually works to be able to actually change it.
Right.
You know, I've seen that in military contracting. I've seen it go through multiple variations. I years ago was in a several-day seminar at the Kennedy School. Some very smart people about naval procurement and very, very difficult issues. And a lot of people's views are based out of frustration.
Sure. And you're looking at Donald Trump. I think he's the perfect example of somebody who is unfamiliar with how bureaucracy works and is unable to actually manage it. And that's always been one of my contentions. If you hire a president or a governor, you want them to have some business experience. Like Mitch Daniels here in Indiana was an infinitely more capable governor because he had managed Lilly, one of the major drug companies. He'd worked for the Office of Management and Budget, so he had some government process. But then Mike Pence comes in, and he's one of the worst governors in modern history because he just was in Congress, and all he did was talk. And so he didn't know how to manage any of the bureaucracy at all. And I think that was part of Bill Clinton's gift at managing the bureaucracy as a president. He had been a governor, and then you see somebody like Barack Obama who is frustrated by the inability to make any changes.
Well, totally. And there are a lot of analogies between the two. So
You've got Trump who has never even worked in government, has no concept of how government works, and has no desire to learn how to manage.
Well, more critically, he didn't run a big business.
Right.
He ran a small family business. So he ran it basically out of his hip pocket. He had fewer people working for him than most major businesses, most mid-level businesses. He ran it on the basis of loyalty to execute this or that. And it's a very different kind of business. Real estate, so he was basically a brand management business, okay? So he didn't have business experience either in the same way that we tend to think of business experience. So the analogy between Donald Trump and Barack Obama in terms of their experience in managing how many people reported to them is pretty closely the same.
Right.
And they run into the same issues. And, of course, as you point out, this is why I think governors actually have a hand up, because they've had to deal with bureaucracies and thousands of people and big budgets, and they have to be the ultimate decision maker, and they have to deal with state legislatures, which are analogous to the Congress. And so governors are a much better choice. And probably somebody like a Jamie Dimon, you know, who has managed a massive, massive bank, hundred plus thousand employees around the world, somebody like that could probably walk in and do a much better job.
Yeah. So what are your general impressions of Donald Trump?
It's, you know, I I may be one of the few people you know who actually predicted that he'd win. I won something like 18 bets. And I won it by actually looking at the numbers. The pollsters did not get the numbers wrong. The pollsters' analysts got the outcomes wrong. You know, even up to the very end, you were seeing 8 to 14, 15 points undecideds in key states. And anyone who's ever been in politics, the rule of thumb, it's undecideds break 2-1 for the challenger. Hmm. And I looked at all that and kind of did that math in my head. And for me, it was pretty easy to tell where it was going to go. But I was no fan, and I admit to not having voted for him, and I didn't vote for Hillary. I voted for McMullen, who was he wasn't libertarian. It would have been nice to have a good qualified guy for that. But I thought that he might he's a transaction guy, and he's brought in people like himself who are basically transaction guys. And I think he doesn't have an ideology. You and I have both talked about that. He's not really a Republican. He's not a Democrat. He's kind of a guy who has an opinion about everything, not based on a
Your boomer uncle at the Thanksgiving kitchen table spouting off about politics that he briefly read on his Facebook page or whatever email was forwarded to him. I mean, he doesn't. Yeah. I don't think that he's an unintelligent person. I just think he's an uninformed. He's kind of the typification of the ugly American, and he's just not intellectually curious. And he's just. I think he's starting to feel his oats a little bit. I mean, he's starting to kind of get the hang of things, and I think that's why you see a little more swagger with things like Iran and North Korea. And there's a little less chaos now than there was this time last year. But by and large, yeah, he has no ideology. His whole ideology is, who is annoying me at the moment? I must fire them.
I'm going to leave you for that description. It's probably a good description. I think, like a lot of people, he's partially informed. Right. Of course, he's getting a lot of advice these days. He ought to have a pretty good information set available on security issues and a lot of other issues. So I'm guessing he's a lot better informed than he was when he came in. But of course, you know, you could probably say that of anybody who becomes president, except somebody like George Bush, who was there for 8 years, and Harry Truman, who's the last vice president who went straight to the presidency. Was kind of kept out of the loop. Richard Nixon was pretty well informed, but he had a gap of 8 years, so he was not right up there. But I think it's hard for anybody to really know what the burden of the presidency is going to be like till you really get there. But I think my hope was that he would, because he didn't have a particular ideology, and because he is a deal guy, I think a lot of us sort of hoped that he would be able to kind of churn his way through some of these things that have been gnawing at us in public and created a lot of the antipathy and kind of this negative back and forth that we have across society today, whether the issue is immigration or the economy or taxes or North Korea or whatever. Some have observed here in Washington that he is doing what a lot of presidents do when they run into the buzzmill of bad domestic PR, all the various suits and everything else, and Mueller and so on and so forth, which is to turn to foreign policy. Hmm. Foreign policy is one of these things that a lot of Americans have an opinion on. A lot have an opinion. Not many know a whole lot about it.
Right.
And the ins and outs. And so there's kind of the talk around here today is, you know, he's doing things that divert people's attention from the other problems. So
now this is going to make the audience, a portion of the audience, their head explode. But you are a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, are you not?
I am.
Okay.
I am indeed.
So part of, and I wonder sort of the reaction from that crowd, because part of what I like about Trump is that he doesn't give a damn what the foreign policy establishment thinks, and that he's willing to do things that, like, he doesn't know any better, and he doesn't, even if he did know any better, he doesn't care, and so he's going to hold his meeting at the DMZ, And then you get Richard Haass, the and all these various foreign policy experts come out and say, oh, this would be a horrible mistake. And then all the pundits at the magazines in New York and Washington start, oh, it would be horrible if he had the meeting at the DMZ. But I think most Americans look at that and go, I don't know why it's a bad thing. I don't know why I should listen to you. But if he wants to do it at the DMZ, go for it, Trump. I mean, you're doing
it. Well, he's actually going to do it in Singapore now.
Okay. But that's – I'm using that –
He's announced the date.
Okay. And so I'm using that as an example where where he just – he's not reading Commentary magazine. He's not attending lectures or having Richard Haass up for tea.
I don't think he reads anything, according to the press. Right?
Of course. So that's part of what attracts me to Trump is that he doesn't listen to the crowd that got us into the Iraq wars. I mean, what is there just apoplexy amongst that crowd when it comes to some of the things like the Iran deal? I mean, I can't imagine what Washington was like when he announced that he was pulling out of that.
Yeah. Well, like every institution, the Council on Foreign Relations reflects a lot of different points of view. There are right wingers on the Council on Foreign Relations. There are left wingers. There are people from George Bush and probably someone all the way back to the Eisenhower administration on the Council on Foreign Relations. There are economists and not everybody's a foreign policy, what you think of as foreign policy establishment. Now, I'm certainly not foreign policy establishment, but I have a company that operates in the Middle East. And I was Federal Maritime Commissioner, so I dealt with international shipping. So that's really how I got in. Jim Baker was my sponsor. Actually, that's a funny story there. He offered to sponsor me, and after some number of years, I thought it sounded like a great idea. And then at that point in time, I was serving on an advisory board to the Wilson Center, one of those establishment groups,
right?
Which was put together to honor Woodrow Wilson. And Lee Hamilton, a very famous Democratic congressman from Indiana, who ran the early hearings on the CIA and all that stuff.
9/11 Commission, yeah.
And 9/11 Commission, too. And that's probably what most people know him for today. Very nice, intelligent, smart, really centrist kind of guy. And I said, well, Lee, would you be a second? He said, Rob, I've nominated a number of people, and no one I did has ever gotten in on the first pass. And so stick with Jim Baker. And so I did get in on the first pass. And I will say it's been one of the most interesting groups of people, and they talk about some of the greatest interesting issues you could ever have. At one point, it's a very famous, at least inside counterterrorism, Australian cultural anthropologist named McMullen, and he worked for David Petraeus, and he was the guy who figured out the Shia Sunni mix and how to kind of reach out and get them all engaged with the central government, and that was part of the turnaround. And it was a briefing for like 12 people, and he talked about how the Al Qaeda was basically bringing the heads of chieftains of their sons to them in ice coolers and offered aid and help to them and everything else. And so it turned out well, but that's the kind of thing I would never have heard in public. It wasn't, I don't think that became public for 2 or 3 years. So it's a mix of people. Some, John Bolton's a member probably. I think every member of the foreign policy establishment on both sides is a member probably.
What goes on there? I mean, are you sacrificing virgins? How many ounces of goat's blood did you have to?
Yeah, we run around and get tattoos on our right cheek.
I think there's a lot of mystery around it, but people don't know what that is.
There's no mystery. It's really public. I think there are like 1,200 members or somewhere plus or minus, and range from young to old. They have a program for young people under 39, you're a temporary member for 3 or 4 years. I don't know what it is now, and then they're life members like myself. They have a lot of speakers and seminars. I've been to, they've got a series now on cybersecurity, and a friend of mine who used to be the NSC and in charge of cyber government policy is running those, and they'll do seminars on various wars, or next week it might be the Saudi ambassador is in to talk about this or that. And it's just a really good way for a lot of people. And I'm guessing half are probably operating businesses today. They're not in the foreign, doing foreign policy, but it's they talk about climate change. They talk about you know, how dry the Sahara is getting this week. They talk about they've done things on education, energy. So it's not as esoteric, I think, as people think it is. And it's probably not nearly as esoteric as it probably used to be 35, 40, 50 years ago. So I will say, when I was working for George H.W. Bush, he was attacked by the right for being a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and other organizations as being elitist. I do think that you can argue that some of these people are a little bit elitist, but you know, they're elitist because they're in the know.
Right. Yeah. I've down like that cybersecurity series is in their podcast feed. So if you're out in the hinterlands like I am, you can go and watch all of this stuff on YouTube or listen to the podcast series with the Wilson Center, the Aspen Institute, the Brookings Institute, completely. Rand Corporation, all these think tanks put all of their information out, just like Cato does, Mises. That's and right. what I always say
and
is
you'll
like,
see me in some of those broadcasts asking questions that other people are thinking but not saying.
Yeah. And so I really encourage people to pay attention to that stuff. When I'm doing research on something like the Iran deal, I go to the Council on Foreign Relations and Brookings and see what they have to say, because it reflects the view of the people who are making decisions just as much as I would going and reading Reason or antiwar.com and Scott Horton. I mean, I think you have to have balance if you're taking in information, but I think they're within the libertarian movement, more of the conspiratorial part of the movement. Oh, if you listen to the Council on Foreign Relations, you're a globalist. And it's just like, no, that's if you listen to the Council on Foreign Relations podcasts, you're probably going to hear all the conspiracies that you in 5 years are going to be. It wasn't a conspiracy. That's it was on a podcast feed.
That's right. Well, and I do think a lot of these organizations today try to combat what is, I think personally, as a technology guy, one of the worst aspects of modern life, which is the tendency to only hear what you want to hear. And, you know, that's actually the outcome of a technology, if you think about it. When Amazon started, you would go on and order a book. They were a book dealer, remember? And they came up with an algorithm that helped find other books that were similar to the one that you just ordered on the assumption you liked it. And that algorithm and others like it today are all designed to reinforce your stovepipe, that's designed to reinforce the ideas you already have, or to appeal to you on the basis of an idea you already have. And that's kind of one of the things that you and I hope can do as we go across this series, is bring to light some things on both sides of the equation.
Well, that's really the whole point of this is I'm sure there are people in the audience who will accuse me of being a heretic for giving a voice to the swamp. but I think it's really important for people to understand, A, that people who work and live in Washington, D.C. and are involved in these circles are human beings and probably are well-meaning. It's just a matter of we have different ideologies. So how did they form their ideas? And, you know, Rob is somebody who's been in Washington, D.C. for 40 years. So he's going to have a totally different opinion than you know, me, who's 34 and has lived in Indianapolis my whole life. and so, you know, I think it's important for us to understand kind of how we got here. And secondly, you know, I think it's interesting. A, he's a very curious person and very interested in what's going on in the libertarian world. So I want to go back, and this will kind of be the last. We're not going to get to your time working on the Ford and the Bush campaigns, but we're going to save and your own campaigns. But so we'll save that as a teaser for next time.
Right.
So let's hop back to Gary Johnson. You said you voted for McMullen. I about threw up, but you didn't vote for Gary Johnson. What was your reason for not voting for Gary?
You know, I always liked him. You know, I met him on several occasions, and when he was running in 2008, I went to a small lunch with him when he was raising money.
2012. Let me just
12,
make sure.
Right. Yeah, it was 12. It was the first time, right. And so I met him. I had always liked him. I liked the fact that he's a kind of an outlier and willing to challenge the establishment. And it, as your viewers and I, we talk, you'll find that I'm kind of on the challenge the establishment side too, even though I'm part of it. I think I was really disappointed in the way he ran the campaign. I think he really had an opportunity to disrupt the election. And instead, he blew it. So before the first debate, you know, they had set a threshold of 10% in the polls, and he was hovering at around 8. And I think that if he were, had been serious, he would have hired himself a good set of social media people, and he would have hired the right kind of people who had got could get him that 2%. But he didn't do it. And, I mean, you know more than I, being in that orbit and set, probably the issues that held him back on that. But I think if he had been in the first debate, he would have he would have really disrupted the process, and we probably would not be seeing the current administration, and I doubt we would be seeing Hillary Clinton. We probably wouldn't have been seeing him. But there are a couple other good choices I think the public could have landed on. So in some respects, I think he blew it.
You and I are in total agreement, and it goes back to Ron Nielsen. And just to be frank, I mean, I don't know what the arrangement was there, but the 2012 campaign I felt was much better messaged. It was much better ran, but they still had some very fundamental problems on strategy. I mean, it's just this is what happens with the LP. You get a guy like a Bob Barr or a Gary Johnson or a Bill Weld who comes in who doesn't really understand the culture. They don't really know the party. They don't really understand where the pockets of strength and resources are in the party. And they hire somebody like Russ Verney, who ran Perot's campaign in Bob Barr's case, or Ron Nielsen in Gary's case, and they start from scratch. And then, and then the party in many cases, although not now, I think that our current chairman has done a very, very good job of getting the party in good shape. And the data from the 2016 campaign actually is reaching candidates now, and which is the first time that's ever happened, which is important. And that's much to Nick Sarwark's credit. Nick could lose because he's too humble to be chairman. He doesn't brag about all the good things he's done. But they don't go to places like Indiana where there is a very strong. They go to places where they think they will be strong, and then they try to build a party from scratch, and it makes no sense whatsoever. And in 2016, they had the Western strategy of trying to drive up the numbers, and I guess on paper back, you know, in 2015, that looked like a great strategy, but there was no pivot from it, and there was no flexibility in it. And, you know, Gary should have fired some low-level staffer and been like, you know, we're changing the messaging the day after Aleppo. Like, there was just no political savviness in that campaign whatsoever. And my concern for Bill Weld is that Weld is considering using Ron Nielsen again, and he shouldn't, because his campaign in 2016 was not well run, and Weld is starting from a much
wasn't professional.
It wasn't, not by any stretch of the imagination.
Aleppo should never have come up.
Yeah, like that's the juxtaposition. You're running against Donald Trump, and so your flub is nothing compared to what the other guy is doing. And so there just was no messaging. And when you don't feed your base in the LP with what they are supposed to say or do, and everybody's just kind of wondering and grasping at straws, there just was never any messaging from that campaign to the grassroots on how to support the campaign. It was much better in 2012, but it still was very weak. And 2016 was just a nightmare. And you know, what is your opinion of Bill Weld?
Oh, I've always liked Weld, but how old is he now?
I think he's 72. He's in his 70 to 75.
Yeah, I think that he may be aging out, I hate to say. What you need is a 39-year-old Bill Weld.
Right. Which we have a guy named Larry Sharp in New York who may beat the Republican in that state for governor. You know, yeah, that I saw Weld speak this past weekend, and Weld really gave a very 90s based policy speech, low taxes, you know, marijuana legalization, a very little spirit, very policy oriented. And that's just not what people want. But he's clearly, I'm sure when you watch the TV interviews, you're like, why isn't Weld the nominee and Gary the vice president?
Although I did, you know, I found it kind of interesting that he was on the ticket. I had never, it never occurred to me he was libertarian. But I think, like a lot of people, he the was base, sort of pushed out of the party.
The party had the same reaction. It never occurred to me that Weld was a libertarian.
Right. But he also was pushed out of the party, the Republican Party. So effectively, like a lot of people. So, but he's a great. He was a very good governor. He was a great lawyer. He was a terrific public servant. Very articulate, smart guy. So, it's kind of a shame to waste him.
What was the swamp reaction to Gary Johnson's campaign?
They ignored it. I think it was a joke in D.C. I just don't think anybody thought he was serious. I think in some ways there may have been some who were more worried about the Greens because of the impact on Clinton. But I think it was pretty much ignored.
Because Jill Stein looks like a serious candidate.
Yeah.
Well, our complaint on the program here with Gary Johnson is you're not prepared to be president. Like, you don't have it doesn't seem like you have your cabinet set up. You know, when you're asked about who your cabinet will be, you kind of fumble, and then Weld goes, "Well, I'd name this person, this person, this person." Go, "Okay, good. At least there's one prepared person on this."
Like, that's right.
And I think when you're a libertarian and you don't have policy initiatives that you can articulate, you don't have a cabinet in mind. Like, let's say you win the presidency, you're going to be less prepared than Donald Trump, because at least he can call up AEI and the Heritage Foundation and hire a bunch of people. You know,
right.
Libertarians don't have that luxury. So I think a lot of us felt uninspired because we didn't know what he actually stood for. I mean, freedom is not a good enough for most voters.
Yeah. Nope, I agree. So,
all right, well,
we're on from here.
Yep. So we are going to just give us a little teaser. I mean, give us a little teaser as to what we're going to hear next in your career.
Well, maybe we can talk about politics. I've been in at a pretty senior level in two presidential campaigns, three presidential campaigns, and I've run a couple times myself and lost. So as my brother says, I'm a loser, a three-time loser. Federal office, but you know, I do love politics, even as bad as it is, and there are days I'm glad I'm not in it anymore, and there are days I wish I were in it. So we can talk about that next if you're interested.
Absolutely. So looking forward to the next time we talk, and thank you for joining us here. Any final thoughts for the audience?
Keep an eye on what happens on the Korean deal, and I think the Iran deal and the fallout is pretty complex. I suspect that both of those will probably do more than most people think they will to come to a decent outcome. But there will be a lot of fallout in between, particularly on the Iranian deal. And we're already seeing the conflict in the Middle East start up.
All right, very good. I don't know. Do you tweet? Are you on social media anywhere? Like,
we will be soon.
Okay. All right. all right. Well, I hope you enjoyed this. If you have questions for Rob, if you have always wondered a certain thing about the swamp and DC and the development of certain politics, please write in at editor@wearelibertarians.com, and I'll be sure to read it here on the show, and Rob can answer it. And we will...
Or dodge it.
Or dodge it. I mean, that's what you people do, right?
Hey, yeah, right.
All right, well, I know you have some drinking and some canoodling that you've got
to do.
All right, well, I'll let you get to it. Thanks for being on the program.
Yeah, thank you. It's fun. Bye-bye.